With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And we're going to be taking one of our dives into everyday Stalinism. Now we're coming; we've been talking about this book for years, and we're coming to the end. And once again, we'll be looking at the functioning and the processes of the great Stalinist terror. But before we go there, I'm kind of curious about gauging the views of the whole Explaining History community. After reading various articles today about the fact that history undergraduate degrees are under threat, not at in the UK, at not at the Russell Group universities, Oxford and Cambridge and Bristol and places like that, but at smaller universities with less resources, where probably often students on lower incomes tend to go, and they're being axed in favour of things like business studies degrees, which will no doubt turn out to be the great white elephants of tomorrow. So it got me thinking, what can we do? Well, here on the Explaining History podcast, I take an eclectic journey through 20th century history. There are things I know more about, things that I perhaps don't talk about enough because I haven't learned enough yet to approach them. But I could, in addition to this podcast, do something more structured. And by that, for people who are excluded from university education through with kind of exorbitant tuition fees and all the other barriers to entry that have been created by New Labour and Tory governments over the last sort of 20-odd years, what if there was a way to provide the same standard of learning? I mean, obviously we can't issue degree certificates here, but we can try to do everything else. So I'm giving some thoughts, and it'll take a bit of planning, a bit of time, a bit of an effort, to creating, in addition to this podcast, a more structured, modularised podcast and perhaps even video channel on the Explaining History YouTube channel. And we would be doing modules in modern history, kind of an approaches to history module, and then various topics of learning, and hopefully we'll get some guests on as well. If this would be attractive, I mean, I don't want to create tons of content that no one's really very interested in, but if this would be attractive and useful, please message me. You can find me on Twitter, you can message me at nick_shepley@hotmail.com, or you can get me on the Explaining History website, www.explaininghistory.com. www.explaininghistory.org. And I'd be really interested to hear some of your views, because we have to make sure that the understanding of the past is not a rich person's hobby. It can't become that. For it will be to the detriment of all of us if it does. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is dive into looking at the year 1937. This is the high point of the Great Terror. And so the question with things like the Great Stalinist Terror is always to ask, well, you know, why 37? Some historians say, well, you know, there was kind of a, this is the sort of the view of Robert Service, that 1937 is just a continuation of everything that had happened over the previous 20 years, and there'd been an endless terror in Russia, which sort of is the case, but that also tells us everything and nothing. So why 1937? Let's find it from Sheila Fitzpatrick. Sheila writes, there have been rumblings ever since Kirov's death and the localised waves of terror that followed it. The first of the three great Moscow show trials of former oppositionists, the trial of Zinoviev and Kamenev in August 1936, initiated a round of arrests of former oppositionists. But this was still on a relatively small scale. Mass arrests in the communist elite and the episode of hysterical witch hunting we now know as the Great Purges began in the first months of 1937, when the January show trial of Yuri Pyatakov and other former communist leaders for counter-revolutionary wrecking and sabotage, and the bloodthirsty plenary meeting of the Central Committee that followed. Although it was almost 2 years before the terror started to wind down, and Nikolai Yezhov was removed as head of the NKVD, the whole episode was long remembered by Soviet citizens as the year of 1937. So 1937 in Soviet memory has a certain kind of dark talismanic power. The three trials had a strong structural resemblance to the show trials of the Cultural Revolution, the Shakti trial and the of 1928, and the Industrial Party trial of 1930. Now, those earlier trials were ways of Stalin kind of positioning himself for not just leadership of the Soviet Union, but also positioning himself ideologically as the deliverer of collectivization and the five-year plans. With the Shakti trial, where there were accusations in Shakti of there being kind of industrial sabotage and of anti-Bolshevik wreckers undermining the hard work of the glorious proletarian revolution, which obviously wasn't the case. It was the fact that particularly the miners in Shakti were put under immense stress, were forced to work exceedingly hard. There were accidents and failings, and these were always explained away as conspiracies against the people. You know, there were wreckers who were trying to undermine the revolution. It's a way of framing Russia as existing in an endless siege state, much as the arrest and trial of the British engineers during the Metro Vickers trial, where British engineers were put on trial and accused of spying for MI6. Whether they were or they weren't is kind of a moot point, really. It's not entirely beyond MI6 to spy on Russia in that way. All these trials create this narrative of endless threat and endless danger. And Stalin himself looked at the rest of the world and saw endless threat and endless danger, and believed that terror was the only way, internal terror is the only way that you keep the revolution safe, by hunting down its enemies, imagined or real. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, the difference was that the then the defendants had been bourgeois specialists, charged as representatives of their class as part of a campaign against the old intelligentsia. The bourgeois specialists, engineers and agronomists and architects and that kind of thing, were almost always identified with being remnants of the old regime. There was a belief that as a result of the revolution, that the old specialists would have to be kind of kept around for a while, but until they could be replaced with proletarian counterparts, until working class counterparts could replace them. And often this was difficult. Often the workers weren't really suitable to take on these highly skilled roles, or have the know-how or the expertise. But because you have people who survived the revolution, found a place within the new Bolshevik order, but who previously had done quite well out of the Tsarist regime, it presents an air of suspicion to a suspicious state, and the possibility of being able to victimise them and to present them as being other or disloyal was actually very, very useful as far as Stalin was concerned. However, this time the defendants were high communist officials, very recently removed from top positions. The inference that they too were on trial as representatives of a class was there to be drawn, but the question was, what class? One possible reading was that it was the class of former oppositionists. The other, considerably more disturbing in its implications, was that it was the whole communist managerial class that was now on trial. The theme of the Pyatikov trial was wrecking, meaning intentional sabotage of the Soviet economy by highly placed officials who were secret enemies of Soviet power. Yuri Pyatikov, one of the chief defendants, was a former supporter of Trotsky who had recently recanted in the early 1930s, but readmitted to the party and become the right-hand man of Sergei Orzhonikidze at the Ministry of Heavy Industry. Part of the context of the purges obviously relates to the assassination of Kirov. And the assassination of Kirov follows the Congress of Victors, where Stalin felt highly insecure, where he recognised that Sergei Kirov was rising in popularity. And Stalin himself was highly criticised for the disaster of collectivisation and the famine that resulted from it. It's all too easy to see Stalin as a kind of this immovable, undefeatable, monolithic figure. But he himself didn't always see himself in those terms and saw threats to him and to his position. And one way of looking at the initial phases of the Great Terror was that they were a way of shoring up the weakness of his position that had been generated by his own mistakes and failings and his own ruthlessness towards the kulaks earlier on. And of course, Soviet agriculture didn't just nimbly bounce back once the famine had ended. Collectivisation and the famine led to a permanent decline in Soviet agriculture that actually lasted for decades. So a few years later, the effects of collectivization would have been sorely felt in terms of hunger in the cities and food shortages, which was one of the regime's great kind of Achilles' heels. Pyatikov was accused of treason against the country, espionage, committing acts of diversion, wrecking activities, and the preparation of terrorist acts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Of all kind of complete fantasies, and yet because this is a show trial, because this is meant to provide theatre, drama to the general public, this sort of level of absurdity actually has a real purpose. It's not simply just hyperbole for its own sake. Prosecutor Andrei Vyshinsky put on a dramatic performance, describing in astonishing detail the awful outlines of the conspiracy of former oppositionists. Their master, Judas Trotsky, and the German and Japanese intelligence agencies against Soviet power. They were a brigand gang, murderers, toadies and cads of capitalism, Vyshinsky claimed. This is not a political party, it's merely a gang of criminals, hardly to be distinguished from gangsters who use blackjacks and daggers on the high road in the dark night. Fearful of the masses, from which it runs like the devil from holy water, the gang conceals its brutal claws and ferocious fangs. The roots of this gang must be sought in the secret recesses of the foreign espionage agencies which bought these people, which kept them, paid for them for their loyal flunky service. Sheila Fitzpatrick also writes, the trial was reported almost verbatim in all national newspapers with banner headlines, photographs of the count defendants, and boxed statements by indignant Soviet citizens calling for the death penalty. As we've talked about many times before on this podcast, the way in which the Bolshevik and later Stalinist Stalinists thought about the individual. And thought about the conscious and unconscious thought, the way they thought about the reformulation of the political individual inside, was that rigorous self-analysis was required, that one must look deeply, go through deep kind of forensic self-analysis to root out the internal traitor, and that the roots of capitalism and the kind of the corruption of the capitalist system ran deep inside all people who had been born under the Tsarist regime, and that people wore many masks. There was a great series of great talk about kind of masks as a metaphor and an actual reality, and that individuals that wore masks were often hiding things that Stalin wrote that, you know, even those who are pretending now to accept the regime, you can't trust them really. Often these are the worst kinds of people, because they're the ones who will be the most difficult to track down, the most difficult to find, and the most dangerous. So show trials were about claiming to get beyond the mask. And the idea of the mask, of the person, the persona that one projects out to the world, that this was kind of disingenuous and inauthentic, and the kind of the product of a capitalist false consciousness anyway. That the revolution had to keep chipping away at this and destroying this artifice again and again and again until the real revolutionary Soviet proletarian individual could finally be found underneath, or until it turns out that you are actually some bourgeois capitalist saboteur and you can be taken out and shot. Stalin, Molotov and Yezhov, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, spelled out the message to a terrified Central Committee at the plenary meeting that began in February 1937. Their speeches lent considerable weight to the reading that the class on trial in the Pyatakov trial was the communist managerial elite. It turned out, they said, that Pyatakov and co. were not the only wreckers in industry. In fact, wreckers were flourishing everywhere in the industrial and transport apparatus, overlooked by complacent communists who'd forgotten about vigilance. And not all the wreckers were former oppositionists. There were enemies of the people in other branches of the Soviet government too. In addition, wreckers and traitors had wormed their way into top positions and the regional party administrations. This was particularly distressing news for the Central Committee, many of whom whose members were themselves regional party secretaries. So what's Stalin trying to say? Why is Stalin turning against the party bureaucracy itself? The party bureaucracy was what Stalin had based his power on. There are a number of possible explanations. The party bureaucracy that Stalin had cultivated contained within it many older figures who had predated the revolution, many who had joined the party in the first year after the revolution, many who weren't necessarily Stalin loyalists, many who could be tainted with accusations of connections to Trotsky, though the numbers of Trotsky loyalists were infinitesimally small. A more useful clue comes in the language of wrecking, of wreckers. Again and again and again, this is articulated, and it is one way of the regime of Stalin, particularly, making up for the shortcomings of everything he's done. The failings of the five-year plans, which, whilst outputs increased in a variety of ways, there were all sorts of shortcomings, industrial accidents, wastes, inefficiencies, poorly sited infrastructure projects, and infrastructure projects rushed through so quickly that they were kind of they crumbled within a couple of years, and that really was the product of regional and local party bosses acting like little Stalins and using essentially brute force, ignorance and belligerence to terrorise and brutalise projects until they're done rapidly, not necessarily correctly. So kind of a purveying sort of hegemonic Stalinism that pervades the whole regime is one of the key factors why nothing works, or nothing works particularly well. Newspapers were a key means of disseminating Stalinist ideas, and Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, Over the next few months, the newspapers carried a wealth of startling information about the sins of leading communists in the centre and the regions. These news items usually refrained from stating outright that the subject had massed as an enemy of the people, had been or would be would shortly be arrested, but this was obvious to any experienced reader of the Soviet press. The stories were written in such a way as to rouse all the latent hostility of Soviet citizens to elite privileges and arbitrary exercise of power. So this is a very kind of skillful and ruthless bit of politics, that Soviet citizens were angry at the party most of the time for the party's corruption, for the favouritism of party members, for nepotism, and for all the other vices that tend to go with kind of established power systems. Stalin was aware of this. He sometimes personally received letters from the general public. I think they didn't use their real names. And by taking that anger and skillfully misdirecting it or redirecting it against those accused in the show trials, to say, you know, these are your crooks and your traitors and your liars and your cheats. This is why nothing works. These are the people that have been embezzling money and taking more than their fair share. The fact that several of them were Jewish, perhaps, I don't think there's any direct evidence for this, but anecdotally tapped into a barely hidden Russian anti-Semitism. Enemies of the people, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, had practiced patronage and favouritism, bullied subordinates and been rude to ordinary citizens, developed their own local cults of personality, used state funds to support a luxurious lifestyle of banquets, dashes, cars, and foreign consumer goods and expensive clothes. This is the kind of rhetoric that was coming out in the newspapers, and no doubt much of it was true, but it was probably doubly true of Stalin and his inner circle. The atmosphere of the time, strongly anti-elitist and anti-bossist, was encapsulated in Stalin's toast in October to little people, in which he remarked that leaders come and go, but the people remain. Only the people are eternal. And it was rather like Mao's Cultural Revolution. Rather like the way Hannah Arendt described fascism as this alliance between the elite and the mob, temporary one. Stalin, the kind of the populist figure in a way, I mean that not in the conception of populist that we have at the moment, was trying to reach over the heads of the party and the bureaucracy to connect directly with the angers, the resentments and the prejudices of the people, and really offered retribution against the party bureaucracy. And this, as Mao later discovered during the Cultural Revolution, and his Cultural Revolution was largely based on the Stalinist terror, we recognised that this was a great way to shore up your position when things had gone wrong. Maybe you were under threat. And it's interesting to note that when Mao undertook the Cultural Revolution in 1966, it's because precisely 4 years earlier, his power had been seriously compromised and seriously threatened, because he too, during the Great Leap Forward, had caused an enormous famine. So as they say, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes from time to time. Anyway, we're going to finish there. I really would be interested in your thoughts about the possibility of running kind of explaining history school, really, to reach out to all the people that would otherwise be excluded from education. Thanks very much, everybody. Do check us out. If you can find us on Patreon, that would be gratefully received. You can find all the links and everything on explaininghistory.org. All Patreon subscribers get extra essays and analysis at least once or twice a month. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.